We're going to start with Linda Matthews, who oversees investigative projects for USA Today. She's been a journalist for 40 years, covered the U.S. Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times, established its Beijing Bureau in 1979. She worked as national editor of the New York Times, senior foreign producer for ABC's ABC News World News Tonight, and also USA Today's cover story editor. And stories that she has edited have won the Pulitzer Prize, the Grantham Prize, and the Casey Medal, and also the Society of Environmental Journalists Prize, Kevin Carmody Award, that was handed out a couple nights ago for a project on air pollution in schools. So anyway, Linda, if you could start out, please. So you've got a slideshow for us. And
yeah, I think I'm not going to start with a slideshow exactly, because it tends to take over. It's highly addictive. You know, I know, because I've, you know, looked up my every school I ever attended, all the schools my children attended, the schools my husband attended, and so forth. And once you get going, you begin looking at, you know, the crosstown rival and everything else. When we started this project, we posed the question, what's the impact of toxic industrial emissions on school children? And as it unwound, there were two parts to the project. One involved using EPA's own computer model to create a database of almost 128,000 American schools and the toxic emissions, if any, that EPA predicted would be in the air outside those schools. The second part of the project involved our going into the field. We went into the field. We monitored the air outside 105 schools in 30 states in a sort of reality check to test the validity of the database. That description makes it sound all kind of clean and simple and straightforward. You know, of course, those of you who are journalists know that it was would guess that it was anything but that. I think the biggest obstacle for us was me, because I was worried that toxic emissions were really a kind of a sideshow, not the main event when you're talking about what the country faces in terms of environmental challenges. You know, there's global warming, there's the battle that we've been doing for almost 40 years now with with ozone and smog. And having grown up in Southern California, where we had smog days instead of snow days, on smog days, you know, school was called off and kids were told to stay inside. We naturally went to the beach instead. But as an adult in living and working in Los Angeles, it became clear to me that those problems were being addressed and that there had been very aggressive reductions in the amount of those pollutants. You know, what turned me around, finally the two reporters I was working with, we kept digging deeper and deeper, looking for proof that there really was a connection between toxic emissions and the health of school children. And we found it. Took us a couple of months. Took a couple of months for them to persuade me, and then for me to persuade my boss, the editor of the paper, that we should proceed. What turned us around? One was a new study done by the University of Texas, which showed an association between an increased risk of childhood cancers and proximity to the Houston Ship Channel. It's an 18-month study. They found that children living within 2 miles of the ship channel, which some of you know is lined with petrochemical plants, rubber plants, you name it, that those children had a 56% higher risk of developing childhood leukemia than did kids living 10 miles away. And the chief culprit appeared to be butadiene, which is often released by petrochemical and plastics plants. We also got a boost from Dr. Philip Landrigan, who is a pediatrician at Mount Sinai Medical Center. Landrigan's research over the years has established that children, especially the youngest, appear to be especially vulnerable to toxic chemicals. Their cells, he said, can undergo subtle mutations that will put them at higher risk, a risk that's lifelong. A decade or even two decades later, those children who faced high exposures may develop cancers, may not. And this can happen, he said, at exposures so low that they probably wouldn't affect adults. Third, we became convinced that the data that we had on what industries were emitting was probably not terribly reliable. The person who turned us around on that was Mayor Bill White of Houston, who in the summer of 2008 wrote a letter to EPA saying, basically, I think that you're under-reporting, that the companies here in my city are under-reporting what they're actually emitting. And the reason he thought that was that they had done a little bit of, the local air agency had done a little bit of testing and had found after one upset at one of these companies in the Houston Ship Channel that more toxic chemicals were emitted in that one day's spill than the company reported as its emissions for the entire year. We put all that together and decided that we would move forward, that this was not a sideshow, you know, maybe in cosmic terms not as important as writing about global warming, but there were other reporters at the paper who were going to do that. And so then we began to try to figure out how to go beyond these kind of snapshots we'd had from Houston and from a site in Ohio where a school had been closed down because of its proximity to a plastics plant was emitting very, very high levels of butadiene. And we came upon something I hadn't known about. I'd known about the toxics release inventory. We'd used it in previous stories looking at mercury from coal-fired power plants. It led us to RISI, Risk Screening Environmental Indicators, which is a computer model compiled by the people at EPA that combines several variables to assess the human health risk posed by toxic emissions in every corner of the country. It looks at, you know, how the chemicals in the TRI spread out from the point of origin. It's based on the chemicals' weight, the local wind patterns, topography, and the like. It looks at how dangerous the individual chemicals are. Obviously, everything in the TRI is toxic, but as we know, some chemicals are more toxic than others. And it looks at how many people live in the affected areas. They put all this together through formulas that I can't really begin to explain, and then project them onto a 100-kilometer grid around the release site of every emitter. So in that way, EPA is able to assess pollution's impact on every square kilometer of the nation. As its name implies, EPA uses this model as a screen for potential problems. Just suggestive, it's not definitive. RISI became the real heart of our project. We liked it because it was based on the best available data from EPA, even though the data was often 2 or 3 years old by the time the model was completed. EPA itself built the model, and it gave us a national reach. which was very important for a newspaper like ours. I've always envied people who, you know, are based in Louisville or Los Angeles or Denver or wherever, because they can concentrate on what's in front of them and what's of greatest concern to their readers. You know, if you're this sort of disembodied homeless organization based in McLean, Virginia, you know, out in the bosky suburbs of D.C., you don't really have a home, and we're constantly trying to, you know, be all things to all people and treat the country as a whole. We made one key adjustment, of course, and that is that because we were interested in the effects on children and schools, we found the locations of 127,800 schools, and with the help of the Political Economy Research Institute at UMass Amherst, plotted them onto the RISI grids. And to make all this information accessible in a way that that the TRI isn't accessible, that RISI isn't acceptable, we devised, with huge help from our IT department, an interactive database so that parents, students, you know, interested citizens anywhere in the country can go online, call up the name of a school, and find out you know, what RISI says about the chemicals likely present around that school in that square kilometer, and what the effects might be. One of my jobs was simply pulling over all material about the health effects of various chemicals. So you can search that. You can search the local companies. You can find phone numbers for the local companies, so that, you know, if you are so moved to make further inquiries, which is what we thought would happen, hoped would happen, it's very easy to do. I think I probably should stop then, and I can show people later kind of how this works.
Okay, sounds good. As you can imagine, when there's big headlines in front of several million people about toxic air in schools, it prompts a response. And that response is being led by Chet Whalen, who's with the U.S. EPA Office of Air Quality Planning and Standards. Chet was kind enough to pull together a tip sheet in the back. So did Linda Matthews as well. They're in the back at some point before you leave. You might want to pick those up. But Chet, please go ahead.
Great.
And you have to speak into the mic so we can get the recording.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Allison, I have a couple of quick slides that may be helpful for taking notes as opposed to trying to catch every word here. But what I wanted to do is walk through quickly a brief overview and description of our project, where we are right now with current status, and where you can find a lot of this information. If we can, yeah. It was the one right above that, I believe.
I think you're wandering through my husband's laptop.
I think it
laptop.
It was already pulled up, Allison, but it was just one above on the yeah. Desktop. Third one up. On the desktop, on the left. On the left. Third one from the bottom.
That one. There we go. Thank you.
Great. Well, EPA began this initiative, was announced back in March of 2009. Initially, we were going to look at 62 schools in 22 states. If you actually go out on the website now, today, you'll see 63 schools plus two tribal schools. The extra school was added as we were trying to establish a monitoring site at one school. They were not comfortable having EPA on their property, so we went to a school right across the street. They were more than happy to have us put up a monitoring site. So the benefit of the proximity to schools is we got two schools for one monitor location. So we went from 62 to 63 schools. The two tribal schools were not initially included as part of our assessment of trying to figure out where we were going to do this monitoring. But after further discussions, we worked with some of the tribal agencies and some of the state air quality agencies, and we came up with some criteria to select the two tribal schools. So we now have 63 public and private schools across the country, plus two schools on tribal lands that we're actually monitoring. the purpose of this study was not to do a long-term, full-blown risk assessment, if you will, but was to do a screening analysis to look at how long-term exposure and toxics and outdoor air around these schools, you know, may impact the health of school children and the community. And just to remind everyone kind of what a screening analysis is you know, it's a statistical study, kind of a subset, where you go in and you do some basic data gathering. You then analyze that information, determine what your next steps will be. Do you need to do more information gathering? Did you find something of concern? And that's really what I want to make sure we emphasize, that this school study for us is starting out as a screening analysis. We're focusing on a diverse set of schools across the country, diverse in many ways. We're looking at schools that are predominantly near large industries, because there may be a source-receptor relationship there, obviously. But we didn't want to focus on schools just at large industries, because toxic air pollution can come from a number of sources. It's not just your large facilities that are reported in TRI, but you can also get toxic emissions from mobile sources. You can get them from small area sources, dry cleaners, things like that. So we wanted to make sure that we had a mix of schools that were kind of focusing on all the different potential sources. So we have the large industries, but we also are looking in urban areas for schools that may be dominated predominantly by mobile sources or a mix of small sources and large sources combined. The way we selected the 63 schools was based on a series of analysis. We obviously looked at the analysis USA Today did that was very helpful in helping us to get a starting point looking at some of these schools. We also, though, looked at our 2002 National Air Toxics Assessment, which, you know, the RISI model is one model. There are various models that are out there that you can use. NADA, or the National Air Toxics Assessment, is another that EPA uses. We think it's a little more comprehensive because it does have all the emissions inventory data in there, mobile sources, area sources, and point sources. Whereas RISI is focused primarily on the large toxic emitters. But I think combined, they both give us a lot of good tools to make this assessment. Once we did that, we came up with a list of schools. We then went out to state and local agencies, EPA regional offices, communities, and we started talking to them about, okay, here's where we are with our kind of top list of schools. What do you know locally about these schools that might give us an indication, or do you have information that's not showing up in our screening models, which is possible, is a model is only as good as the data that goes into it. And so we worked, vetted this process back and forth about 2 months or so with these agencies. Some schools dropped off our initial list. Some new schools were added. And we ended up with where we are at the 63 schools. But it was kind of a back and forth to make sure we were not only just picking schools based on our screening tools, but also based on some local knowledge that was coming from the agencies. The next map, this is just a map to kind of show where they are. So not only are we looking at diversity in the sense of the types of emissions that and sources that might contribute to these schools, but also geographical diversity. I think we're in all the EPA regions but two. So we have a fairly good coverage across the country trying to get a rough idea of what's going on at these different schools. The monitoring plan, what we plan to do and what we are actually doing at many of these schools now, the first thing we did was develop a national monitoring plan and a quality assurance plan because we wanted to make sure that the monitoring done at each school was consistent. In other words, we're not monitoring necessarily for the same pollutants at every school because these screening models allow us to get some idea about what the drivers, the risk drivers might be at those schools. So one school, maybe you're looking for heavy metals. Another school, you may be looking for volatile organic compounds. So you wouldn't necessarily need to monitor for metals where you think the risk driver is volatile organic compounds. But, for example, where we were monitoring for metals at any school, we're using the exact same protocol, the exact same monitoring procedures. And we wanted to make sure that we had that out there so that we could compare these results from school to school where we were looking for similar pollutants and make sure that there was nothing done differently on the lab analysis or the monitoring specs. What we set up for the screening analysis is to monitor for 60 days. The way toxic sampling is done nationally through federal federal methods is what's called a 1-in-6, which means you sample once every 6 days. So over a 60-day period, you'll get roughly 10 samples. We encouraged and requested that wildcard samples be taken at these schools, primarily so that potential industry couldn't look at that and say, okay, they're monitoring every 6 days. I'll just scale back my emissions on those days, and the monitoring will come clean. We put in wildcard samples that no one would know when those samples would be taken, and then that data would be provided to us along with the other 10 samples. The lab results for each sample are validated and QA'd. We have a central lab that EPA is funding that is analyzing all of the samples. The state and local governments are out there actually doing the monitoring with us. EPA is providing the equipment and the analysis. And then the data comes in. It's validated by EPA scientists as well as coordinated with the state and local air agency scientists and make sure that the samples are solid and that they're good samples, and then the information is put it up on the web. kind of the interim release, what we're doing is there's always a push to get information out quickly, and we want to be as transparent as possible with this. But we also recognize you need to be responsible in reporting data. And when you're trying to look at, you know, long-term information, putting up one sample right away before it's validated is probably not responsible. So we wanted to make sure that the data was validated, it was QA'd, that everyone was comfortable. So there is a little bit of a lag between when the sample's taken and when it actually comes up on the web. But that's anywhere from a couple of weeks to, you know, 4 weeks or so, depending on how long it takes us to validate the sample. But we are putting up data up in an interim stage. We're not waiting till the end of the screening analysis to put all the data up. It is available on the website. The samples that are going up there right now are compared to a short-term exposure level. At the end of the screening analysis, we will do a long-term estimate of the impacts, and we will compare those to a long-term health effects level. And so we're trying to accommodate the need to get information out there quickly, but also to make sure that we do the long-term analysis at the end. And at the end, the summary reports will be developed for each and every school. Well, what we'll do with that is we'll look at the 10 to 15 samples, depending on how many wildcard samples they took. We will compare those to long. We will average those, look at 95th percentile comparisons. In other words, look at, you know, recognizing that 10 samples is a very limited number to do a long-term analysis with. We wanted to, you know, put some certainty into that by putting variations around the value, the mean value. You know, what could it be? What could it be for the 95th and 25th percentile, for example? And then look at everything else that goes on around that school as well. What direction was the wind blowing on the days the sample was taken? What are the sources around the school? How were they operating during the period of sampling? Were they operating at capacity? Were they shut down because of economic concerns? Were they below capacity because of economic downturns? We want to look at all that information at the end of this and do an analysis for each school, and that analysis will be put on the web, which will basically lay out the next steps after we've completed that. And it could be one of many options once you've completed that analysis. We see nothing there. We look at the data. The sources are in compliance. They're operating at full capacity, and we're not seeing anything at the school. It may be a recommendation not to continue monitoring at that specific school. We may see information that says, you know, we don't see any real problems here, but some of the numbers are of concern. They're not above any thresholds, but we'd like maybe to continue monitoring to make sure, so we would do additional monitoring. And then, of course, the third option was if something shows up of concern, we would want to take action quickly and try to move in there and look at compliance issues, look at voluntary reductions where compliance is not an issue. So we really have multiple outcomes from this analysis, and we will know that after we've completed the screening analysis at each school. The current status, just to let you know where we are right now, we have two schools that are actually done in Tennessee. We had an EPA regional office out of Atlanta who was able to get equipment mobilized very fast when we started this project. So they were way out in front of the other schools. For all of the other schools, we had to order equipment. The equipment had to be manufactured in many cases. Then it had to be shipped. It had to be deployed. It had to be set up. So it took a little while to get the equipment out there. But the two schools in Tennessee are done, and the final analysis for those schools are on the web right now. And the recommendations for those schools are out there. We have 54 sites currently operating monitors, assessing 61 schools. The reason the numbers are a little different is, again, some places you have an elementary school and a middle school right next to each other on the same property. You can set up one monitor in between the two, and you get benefits of both schools there. So those 54 sites are ongoing right now. Some sites are starting to come to wrap up in the next couple of weeks. Some are just starting. So this will be kind of spread out and sequentially over the next several weeks, next several months, excuse me. All the data is posted on the website, www.epa.gov/schoolair. And in that data, as I said, it has the interim data, as is posted for each school, and it will also have the final results for each school posted out there. And the next two slides really just give you, so you'll know when you see it, so to speak. This is the School Air website. This is the home page. On the right over there where it says announcements is where we will always post any new information that's come out. If we find anything in the interim or if there's additional supplemental information, we'll post it right there so folks can find it quickly. About a third of the way down, it says EPA selected schools. The highlighted link, they're selected schools. If you click on that, you go to the next page, which is a listing of all of the schools. If the school is highlighted, it means we have data out there right now for it. If it's not highlighted, it means we have not posted the data for those schools yet, but as soon as that data is posted, the school becomes highlighted. And I didn't go all the way down here, but when you click on one of the schools, you'll get the specific information about that school, what's being monitored at that school, what the current data shows, and if we finish at that school, you'll also have the long-term report for that school as well. And there are also links throughout here into other toxics information where you can get additional resources, as well as on the handout in the back. There's some additional resources for air toxics.
That's great. Between the USA Today database that they assembled and the posting of this data by EPA, there's stories that you all can be doing in your communities, and I encourage you to explore both. Now, I've always said that I don't mind scaring people with these with stories that I do about the environment, as long as there's a good reason to do that, as long as there's a good reason to scare people. But I don't mind doing that. I don't mind scaring people. Is that a good approach? Sharon Dunwoody is an expert in risk communication, environmental and risk communication. She's on the faculty here. She's a longtime SCJ member, and she's... many of you have probably seen her several times already at this conference. She's just really doing a lot of great work here. Anyway, maybe you can answer my question.
Yeah, we'll see. And of course, the answer to all those questions is it depends.
It depends.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I appreciate Jim's inviting me to do this, because this series of articles was beginning to win awards, like all, you know, information seekers, I went and took a layperson's look at it, did a rapid sort of Greyhound-like, you know, trip through this. And then when Jim invited us to come talk about this, I went back and had the opportunity to really sit and read. I know it's a website, but I still refer to this as reading, exploring all the avenues that you can take through this series. The awards for this series are well deserved. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, do take that opportunity. It's in many ways a classic investigative effort that in the tradition that many of us who teach journalism, you know, hope will be preserved over the millennia. And so it's a pleasure to see this. Of course, it is communicating about a risk to the nation, if you will, inviting readers to come in and explore what may be going on at their local level. And what I tried to do then is to take a look at this from a risk communication perspective. And I want to talk about some really strong elements in this set of stories. And then as a second point, to reflect on a few things that I found myself struggling with, and I hope that will generate some interesting conversation yet this morning. As you've heard from Linda, one of the really strong pieces, elements of this series is that it's a data-based investigation. USA Today really took seriously issues of evidence here. Not only did they go to existing data and then employ, consult with analysts to use it in a sophisticated way, but they also went out and did a little bit of data gathering on their own, again, to look at some of these issues. And it's really apparent as you read this series that what their, you know, their reactions are grounded in those data. I also, again, very important from a risk communication perspective, despite the national nature of this, and Linda was reflecting on the frustrations of trying to figure out how to bring this home to readers, it does a fabulous job of that, in the sense that, you know, you go in there and you can pick your state, you can pick schools, you can go in and look at a very specific level at what their analysis has found. And the ability to get that specific, it's something that in the, you know, days of yore, when all we had were newspaper columns or, you know, television, you couldn't do this. But now with the web, you can actually allow readers to move off to some of these very, very specific exploratory sites. And I think that is, you know, one of the absolute strengths of this multimedia world we live in now, and a really excellent part of that series. Another thing I liked about it is that it's effort to try to explain things to readers who, I mean, you're basically, if you come in and you find out that your school, you've got kids in a school and you find out that there's, that the school is on a list of, a rank ordered list of sites that have been shown to have contaminated air, you know, your red flag goes up, level of worry goes up. You now need to understand what's going on, and you need to understand what to do. And the series, I think, does a good job in many ways of trying to explain what's going on. There's some interesting graphics on there, again, that, that work very well on the web that, that show you how contaminants can, you know, how air can move contaminants around a site. A lot of very interesting stuff there that I think is helpful to readers who are now kind of worried about this. Another thing you have to help readers with when they encounter these kinds of things is the high levels of uncertainty that are going to accompany a topic like this. Because in many respects, no one knows in many ways how dangerous these things are. And any, you may know how much is there, but knowing what their effects will be is highly uncertain. Knowing what, and so again, I think stories have to try to cope with that. One thing I really like with this series, and again, I think this is a web function. I didn't see the series in its official hard copy version, but there's a Q&A on this series that you know, tries to pose the kinds of questions that concerned individuals will have, and I think that's a really great idea. I found myself, after reading the series, going to that Q&A, and I read that Q&A perhaps more closely than the series itself, looking for, you know, saying, are the questions I have now in here somewhere as I moved through. And finally, another thing I liked a lot about this from a risk communication perspective is what now, in a sense, I call this enabling information. You know, you've read this thing, you've got a kind of sketchy grip on something that may or may not be awry in your home environment. By home, I mean community here, school environment. What do you do about that? And so, for example, there are repeated comments in, I don't know if they're in the series or in all the material that I was looking at, that says, don't worry, but don't panic, okay? In other words, it's appropriate to be worried, but, you know, for God's sake, don't pull your kid out of the school. And then you can find information on the site that suggests what steps you might take next in order to explore what to do. And I think that's really critical. If you scare people to death without giving them options, you can paralyze them. You can create overreaction to risks that I think are quite inappropriate. I also want to throw out a few sort of cautionary elements that as I was reading this, and it'd be helpful to hear from Linda on a couple of these. There are a couple of, I talked about the importance of sort of vivid personal, a way of getting the reader close to the information. You know, readers are going to hit these stories and say, how does this matter to me personally? What do I need to do about this? How do I find out what's going on within my world? It's a particular challenge for national media, but local media have the same issue with exactly where in a community this is taking place and what, you know, who needs to be appropriately worried about something. But there are also a classic way for journalists to also manage this is with a personal story, where you go out and you find people who are wrestling with these issues, portray the frustrations and strategies they're employing as a way of helping readers see how they could be engaged or what they get a sense of what they should be doing. There are a couple of very personal accounts in this series, extraordinarily vivid. In fact, as I get away from this series, I find myself, you know, what I remember, in addition to being able to go to the schools that in my community and check out what's going on, I remember Matt Becker, for example. Matt is a young man who ended up being diagnosed with cancer. And what I'm wrestling with now, and this is just somebody as a reader, is the issue here is it's a fabulous story, extremely vivid, very emotional story about a young man who's in remission now, but, you know, again, has had to wrestle with cancer at a very young age. Imagine what that must be like as you move through adulthood, never having the option of not worrying about this. The question that I'm raising as I read this is, you know, what's the link between the pollution and Matt? What I was able to find in the series was that scientists thought that a link was a plausibility. So as I think about this, I ask myself, and as I work with students, I'm sort of staring at Eric here, who's one such, is a plausibility enough for me to go with a highly vivid account? I personally would like a probability, a relatively high probability of something before I do a kind of very personal account, because I think those personal accounts, as we create distance between these narratives and reader, the personal accounts take on a causal element. People start to view them as having, is not being possible, but being probable. So if I'm going to do these highly vivid and again wonderful components of stories, I think my sense is to try to only do them when there is a probability that there is a link between these two things. And again, I'll be interested in others' reactions to that. Another thing I wished I had more of as I read this story was I wanted to know more about these chemicals. I wanted to know, some of them were named, but I felt at the end of the series I had a kind of more generic cloud of things out there, and I just wasn't entirely sure what they were, what the specific risks were of these individual chemicals. Again, this is a sort of reader reaction to a large body of stuff, very hard to react to for writers. And the last thing I guess I would, and this is something that I've appreciated, it's more present for a reader on the web. Being able to follow up on a story like this is, I think, really important. Those of us who read the old hard copy world, follow-ups are hit or miss. They happen and we may or may not see them. On the web, you can actually go and look at follow-up stories, and indeed USA Today has done a conscientious job of tracking policy responses to this. I also found myself wanting to know how everyday people were coping with this. And there may be stuff on the site. I was struggling to find it. In that non-linear world of the web, I don't know about you, I kind of get in there and get stuck in a little cubicle here and have to back my way out, and then I couldn't find stories that reflected the work of individuals at some of these schools who, as a result of this learning about this, were actually trying to cope with this in some way. Again, I'd love to see stories like that, and there may well be ones on the site, and I simply failed to notice them. But again, it's a great set of stories for those of you who haven't yet seen it.
Thank you for that. A few years ago, when I did a number of stories on hazardous air pollutants in Louisville, it was the first time I'd actually taken on that subject. I'd come from California, and we have the green issues out and the brown issues that we cover, and I was more of a green issue reporter, and I moved back east, and there's a lot of pollution, and so then I had to become a brown issues reporter. And I found that there really were very few people, very few lawyers that knew the Clean Air Act, Clean Air Act's provisions about hazardous air pollutants, that could really help me get down in the weeds in them. And one of them was James Pugh. It looks like he's not here. This is table. There's nobody behind his table tent, but this is a cramped little table. But he's sitting in the front row. And I asked him to help us figure out what rocks, as journalists, we can overturn for maybe the next round of stories, where we might be looking, where we should be looking for our coverage. And James is with, I'm sorry, he's with Earth Justice's Washington, D.C. office, B.A. in history from Stanford, M.A. in law from Cambridge University, and a J.D. from the University of Pennsylvania. He's practiced law at a private law firm in Philadelphia for 3 years, was with NRDC for a while, and he's been with eight years with Earth Justice. He works out of Washington, and thanks for coming.
Well,
should
I could just stand up and talk.
Yeah, you need to use the microphone, though. So
we can pull one of these out.
Yes.
It
pops out. Only it pops out. So
we're recording it, so you don't have to hear the microphone.
It may pop out.
There you go. Thanks. Well,
I really enjoyed the USA Today article and the series of articles, and especially because one thing that I've noticed as I work on this, and of course the reason I'm here is because I'm hoping that people will write more of these stories, is that reporters find air toxics really daunting to write about, because you quickly get lost in conversations about risk levels, which are really arcane, or competing claims about costs and benefits of controls that nobody can really evaluate. And so I think a lot of people react by just not writing about it. And so finding a way to write about it in this sort of difficult issue in a way that people care about is really impressive, especially if you have to do it on a national level. I think it's probably easier to do on a local level, because what makes it interesting is when you can find some hook that makes people care about it. So before I sort of get started on story suggestions and issues to look at and investigative tools, maybe the best thing I can do is provide some of the legal background, because I think that frames how you have to look at these stories. And I'll try to do that as quickly and in a non-arcane way as I can. But Congress first started addressing hazardous air pollutants or toxic air pollutants, those are synonyms, in the 1970 Clean Air Act. And it did it in what seemed like a very common sense way. It used the newly created Environmental Protection Agency, which was supposed to be the expert on health and toxics, and said to the agency, you, agency, go identify all of the air pollutants that are hazardous, using a fairly common sense.
We didn't want to. Spotlight is okay. Blue is.
using a fairly common sense approach, go identify the chemicals that can kill people and make them really sick. Those are the ones that you're going to identify as hazardous, and then set national standards at a level that will reduce those hazardous air pollutants to a level that will protect people with an ample margin of safety. Which all makes very good sense, but it was a complete failure. In 20 years, EPA identified 7 pollutants as hazardous and regulated even fewer of those, and the reason is that the process quickly got hijacked by industry, which didn't want to pay for the controls to reduce those pollutants. So after 20 years, in 1990, Congress amended the Clean Air Act to take a whole different approach. Instead of relying on EPA to identify which pollutants are hazardous, it listed 188 of them right in the Clean Air Act. And instead of relying on EPA to decide what levels were safe, it directed EPA to go industry by industry and ensure that each industry reduced all of the hazardous air pollutants emitted by the maximum amount that was achievable. So instead of sort of a risk-based approach, it took a technology-based approach, and instead of going pollutant by pollutant, it went industry by industry. And that was supposed to cut through this whole problem and get to results even before we knew what the risks were. And that's part of the problem is we still don't know what the risks are, and if we wait until we do know what they are, we'll have suffered the results of these unknown risks for more and more years. Well, that approach unfortunately didn't work very well either. EPA quickly fell behind in getting out these standards. There are over 100, 150 different industries that had to be regulated. EPA fell behind, and when it did issue standards, the standards tended to be watered down because there's no getting around the fact that the agency is a political one, and it's subject to political pressures, and so the standards that were coming out were far less protective than the Clean Air Act required. And then the Bush administration came in and things got even worse. Earth Justice started challenging both EPA's failure to set the standards and EPA's issuance of watered-down standards in court in the 1990s. And since then, there have been about 12 or 13 decisions on this very specific issue that have come out and made it all the way to a reported decision in court. And to give you a sense of how bad the agency's program was, the agency won one of those cases. So that pretty much brings us up to date. We now have a new administration that is enthusiastic about addressing this issue, I think for the first time ever, and that's really encouraging. They've already come out with a standard for medical waste incinerators, which emit a lot of toxics, that will reduce, that cuts the old emission standards by orders of magnitude and will provide big reductions in pollution. They've issued a proposed standard for cement kilns, one of the worst industrial polluters of any kind, that will come out next June. And if the proposed standard is issued in its formal current form, it will reduce emissions of these these toxic pollutants by 70 to 90%. And by EPA's estimates, it will save 600 to 1,600 lives a year. So EPA is now on the right track. and that's really encouraging. They have a very, very strong law to work with. This is probably the toothiest environmental statute that exists, and they have very clear guidance from the Clean Court, from the courts about what the Clean Air Act means. So that brings us up to date. And so what are stories to look at that might be worth looking into? One thing I would say is you can look at, on an industry by industry basis. For instance, you could look at cement kilns. Cement kilns are an industry that we've found are invariably accompanied by controversy. We haven't ever seen a cement kiln that doesn't have a community nearby that's upset about the cement kiln's emissions. And that kind of conflict, as far as we can tell, is one of the best things to lead to a good story. There are 100 of them around the country. EPA standards, to provide some national context, are coming out in June. Those standards are going to require a major change in behavior by almost every cement kiln in the country. And those changes, I think, can be set against what in many cases has been a decades-long struggle with the neighbors to get this very pollution down. Another issue is power plants. Power plants are the single worst toxic emitter of any kind. Amazingly, they have escaped regulation, at least in terms of their toxics regulation or their toxic emissions, completely. They've never had any toxics regulation at all. And many of them haven't, most of the existing ones have been grandfathered for the other kinds of pollution that they emit. So if you look at an individual toxics, at an individual power plant, once again, you'll probably find a community that really cares about the pollution, probably can't do anything about it because the plant is, most of the existing plants are old enough to have been grandfathered. So they have no real tools to require significant cuts. These cuts are coming down the pipe on a national basis in the next couple of years. This is the holy grail of pollution control. The air toxics requirements are the ones that are going to get these old power plants to finally reduce their emissions. And actually, there was an interesting trade press article that came out in the last couple of days from EPA's air director who said this is finally the thing that is going to get these polluters under control, and this is going to be the driver for our program. Incinerators are another good topic. There are hundreds of incinerators all across the country, whether they're burning municipal garbage or medical waste or industrial waste. All of them are burning things that either don't burn, like metals, and simply go up into the air, or are burning things like plastics that generate toxic organic pollutants. I've hardly ever known an incinerator that doesn't have an angry neighborhood around it, because they're perfectly well aware of what's coming out of the... Well, they may not know exactly what's coming out, but they're perfectly well aware that what's coming out is unpleasant because they smell it. They see the results landing on their homes and their cars and their gardens. One of the issues I think I would love to see reporters dig into is risk, because the way that EPA looks at risks from toxics is essentially the easiest and cheapest and probably least effective or least accurate way to do it, and that is take a pollutant, say benzene, which is a known carcinogen. EPA will assign it will assign a number to benzene, and that number will reflect how carcinogenic benzene is. And it will essentially multiply that number by an estimate of what the emissions are and the exposure is for a person to come up with a general cancer risk to the population from that pollutant. But we know that's not really the whole story, because we know that we can't necessarily get a really accurate number for any pollutant, for the potency as a carcinogen of any pollutant, because it varies from person to person. Children are known to be more susceptible than others, and some people are known to be more susceptible than others. And likewise, we don't really know what the actual exposure level is. So what about epidemiological surveys? Certainly we've done that for lots of for other pollutants. We've done that for particulate matter, for example, so that you actually go into the community and see how many people are sick and correlate that to exposure to toxic pollutants. Is it difficult to do or expensive? Probably. But is it impossible? By no means. One of our clients runs a small environmental group, an environmental justice group in Los Angeles. His name is Jesse Marquez, and it's surrounded by a number of refineries and the Port of Los Angeles and a number of freeways. And he decided that he was seeing a lot of sickness in his community, and he wanted to find out how bad the problem was, so he simply hired a bunch of, at very low cost, people to go out and survey the members of his group, and they got a survey for 600 or 700 people. What they found was that the rates for leukemia were about 1 in 20. Well, you know, by EPA's numbers, they're supposed to be 1 in a million, maybe 10 in a million, maybe 100 in a million at worst, but 1 in 20 is off the charts. Now, was his survey, a formal epidemiological study or academically defensible? Academically solid? No, and he knew that perfectly well. He wasn't trying to do that. But what he found pointed out a big and, in my view, scandalous gap in our knowledge. How come we don't know how many people are getting sick and what the actual risks are, and how come we aren't making an effort to find this out? Anyway, if I point that out as something that's a question that's worth asking. The last thing that I would dig into is monitoring and enforcement. How do we really know what's coming out of a plant? In a lot of cases, the monitoring techniques are laughably bad. For example, a plant might have to actually test its emissions once every year or once every 5 years. So what it's emitting the rest of the time is unknown. Or the monitoring technique might be as laughable as somebody, a company employee, walking outside and looking at the smoke coming out of the smokestack and deciding whether that smoke is too dark or not. And believe it or not, that is one of the main monitoring methods for pollution. So finding, asking a question of how do you know what's coming out of the plant, I think is one of my favorite questions, because often the answer is going to be, I don't know. The other is, how can compliance with standards, whether they're weak or strong or in the middle, how can that be enforced? And one of the big problems over time has been that there's been a very convenient loophole that provides that if ever a source malfunctions, it may be exceeding its emission standards, but it's not actually liable legally for those exceedances. Well, as it turns out, sources aren't dumb. Just about every exceedance that ever happens turns out to be a malfunction. And so there's never any liability, and so there's hardly ever been an enforcement case brought under the air toxics provisions, which is kind of like having a speed limit without having any police around. And I say that without any meaning in any way to convey anything but respect for the enforcement group at EPA, because they work very hard and do a very good job, but the tools often just aren't there for them. So I think looking into those questions and asking very specific very specifically, how do you know what's coming out of this plant? What's the compliance record been, and what has been the record of so-called malfunctions to get a real sense of what the emissions are and what the communities are facing are good questions. Finding out what the community knows, because usually there are community groups, but their access to information isn't very good, and what they, what the gap is between what's actually known about the emissions and what their anecdotal evidence is of what's coming out of the plant, instances where they, for example, smelled bad smells, found residue on their cars, saw flares. Those are all things that I think lead to very good stories.
Great. Thank you very much. Before we get into some questions here, I have one question for Linda that follows up on Shane's line. Say I'm a reporter working for you, and I and you're my editor, and I discover that there's maybe a family or a person or whatever that there's some cancer cases or whatever, and there's some industry nearby, and how do you, as an editor, how do you decide whether to draw that link or not in a story, and how strong of a link does it have to be in order to be a story? Do you need, or to be part of a story, do you actually have to have a doctor sign some, get a doctor's diagnosis, which is almost impossible, or anyway, that's kind of the gist of it, please.
No, we went round and round about that, because obviously, from the moment we started the project, we wanted to find real life victims, people who had developed cancers or other serious illnesses because of their exposures. Sharon mentioned Matt Becker, really, you know, charming 17-year-old whose parents found out when he was 15 and complaining of chest pains that he had a tumor 6 inches by 8 inches inside his chest. It was a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Wherever we went in this town in Ohio, it's a town called Addison, Ohio. It's a suburb of Cincinnati. People knew about Matt. His parents worried that their choice, the place they'd chosen to live had put their child at risk. Probably the treatment he got made him sterile. He's afraid of that. His parents are afraid of that. They can't prove that these carcinogens that were coming from the plastics plant a couple miles away from where they live had anything to do with it. Nobody has ever, you know, looked hard at the cancer tissue that was removed from his chest to see if it could be tied in some way, I don't know, through DNA analysis or something, to what was coming out, to the chemicals coming out of the Lanxess plastics plant. I'm not, Sharon, I thought, raised a very legitimate question. Is it plausible? Is it only plausible that there was a cause and effect going on here? We finally decided that we would be utterly straight about what our experts, the people, mm-hmm. the pediatricians, the scientists at the schools of public health at Johns Hopkins and the University of Maryland were talking about. We tried to underplay it. Mm-hmm. I think how often do you know what causes each cancer? We found, victims in other places too. And in some cases, they couldn't be identified because there was a group of a couple of dozen graduates of Port Neches Groves High School in Port Neches, Texas, who developed cancers in their 20s and early 30s, and found a willing lawyer who brought civil suits against 3 of the companies that, according to federal data, were responsible for emitting carcinogens at very high levels. The suits never went to trial. They were settled. The pleadings were sealed. We found one person who had sued more recently, and he and his lawyer were willing to talk because no money had changed hands. There was no settlement. It is the greatest one of the greatest obstacles I think you face in telling a story like that, and again we tried to be modest in describing what happened to Matt and modest in representing our own findings too. With the database we built, we tried to make it clear in the Q&A, in the methodology, that there's no bright line between safe and dangerous in the rankings of these schools. The schools can be compared only to one another. You can't say, only the schools in the top 1% or the top 10% at those schools are the kids at risk. You can't say that if your school is in the 80th percentile, this is one of those things in which you want your kid to be in the 80th percentile, there's nothing to worry about. We found surprises at both ends when we actually dug into some of this data. We found, for example, that the school that came out number one in the database, Ashland City Elementary in Ashland City, Tennessee, which EPA has already monitored, the problem was not nearly as great. We monitored ourselves there twice using equipment far less sophisticated than what EPA used, little pumps about this big, you know, samplers that are used by university labs, but not these gigantic canisters and the like that EPA and state health agencies employ. And we monitored at Ashland City twice because we really wanted this one to be legitimate. And we found levels of manganese only 1/1000th of what the database, what RISI said should be there. One of our reporters chased down the manager who had filed the initial TRI reports to EPA and discovered that they were counting as emissions all the shards of steel. This was a company that made hot water heaters, and they were counting as emissions all the little shards of steel that contained manganese that ended up on the cutting room floor in this plant. The reality was that they were all swept up and removed from the site. They were not emitted into the air. So Ashland City ended up at the top of a list. It didn't deserve to be there because of a misunderstanding, I think, on the part of, you know, of a well-intentioned guy who thought he was reporting what he was supposed to be reporting.
Yeah, the TRI is a great database, but there are some issues with it sometimes.
Yeah, it has many, many shortcomings.
Yeah.
First of all, you know, as Jim pointed out, you know, these exceedances don't have to be reported for it as for anything else. You know, we also found out, you know, that there were some places where the risks were very much understated. My favorite example of that is a school on the coast, that beautiful coast north of Santa Cruz, California, where I would have bet from many vacations I've spent there was nothing to worry about in the air. But Cal EPA and the local air control districts in California began checking cement kilns. They found chromium-6, which is hexavalent chromium, which is a carcinogen, at a cement kiln in Riverside County down in Southern California, and then methodically decided to check all the other cement kilns run by the same company. So they got to this beautiful little town and found such high levels of chromium-6 that they closed the kiln down. There were dozens of meetings. The parents talked about closing down the school. None of this showed up in the EPA database, I think because of a geographical error. On the map that was provided, the cement kiln was located 10 miles out of town instead of in the middle of the town near the elementary school. It's not something we would have detected or anybody else would have detected. It does show you something about the limitations of the database.
Okay, questions, comments, questions? The policy, as you know by now, is SCJ members first, please, blue tags. Yes, please. And please identify yourself and your publication.
I'm Laura Frank. I'm from the University of Colorado.
Okay.
I just had a comment and a question. I've heard quite a lot. I'm a 20-year newspaper reporter. The Rock Mountain News. And having covered a lot of environmental health stories in the past, getting from possibility to probability is a much higher bar than it sounds like on the face of it. So I'm not sure if you waited for probability, in most cases you would never write this story. And I think that this shows how important it is to get at the heart of what the stakes are.
Yeah, because we're limited, because I've allowed this to go a little longer than maybe I should have, I'm going to try to focus the answers to maybe just an individual, and I think that one goes to you, Sharon.
Yeah, and again, you're absolutely right, and I actually don't. I advocate writing about possible risks, even ones where the certainty about cause and effect is totally up in the air. The issue I was speaking to is a particular tactic in a story that creates an extraordinarily vivid narrative that's going to overwhelm somebody's meaning for the story. So I was addressing a specific tactic here, which is to tell a story about an individual, generate an enormous amount of sympathy and a sort of emotional reaction in the reader, which is a great tactic for journalists. But what we've learned as we look at how people remember risks is that particular anecdote then becomes the story and begins to take on, as time goes by, a much more concrete causal connection in somebody's mind. And so all I'm saying here is that if a risk is plausible, I think go for it as a writer, with all of the caveats that I think in the series that they tried, they worked very hard to incorporate, and quite successfully. But if you then move ahead with this kind of vivid anecdotal story, you're predisposing the reader to begin to see that as a probable connection rather than a plausible one. So I'm focusing on the meaning that a reader will attach to that. So it's a tactic, not a question of whether you write the story or not.
Okay. Yeah.
When we went on to the second part of our project, which was actually going out into the field and monitoring the air at schools, we did exactly that. We were looking at 105 schools to begin with, 70% of them chosen from kind of the top 10% in the database, and the others representative of every decile down the way. And we involved our own correspondents, in Seattle and Los Angeles and New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Atlanta, etc. We brought in reporters from other Gannett properties, TV stations and newspapers, also, you know, that belonged to the same mother company. And then we had what we called the volunteers. Most of them were people I knew in places where I couldn't find anybody else to do the monitoring. I think my relatives became afraid to answer their phones for a while. When we printed the names of all these people and identified them as volunteers, one of my husband's cousins called up and said, "I didn't have the sense I was volunteering." There are organizations now that help organize local people who want to investigate a situation on their own. One of them is called the Global Monitoring Initiative. It runs out of the Bay Area, but we'll teach people how to do monitoring, how to lobby for monitoring to be done by local organizations. They've done things in Claymont, Delaware. I think they had some role in a monitoring project in West Virginia. They've been dueling with a steel plant in Berkeley itself. And Earth Justice may also, play a role in dealing with locals who want to find out more about what, if anything, they can do.
Yeah, and some of us have had experience with the Bucket Brigade, too.
Right.
Carolyn.
Wanted to ask Chet if there's, I guess, maybe depending on the outcome, if in
Yeah, I mean, and I think you're right. The criteria approach, ozone and PM, we have different. The Act sets up different ways for things to do. I do think we have a toxics monitoring program. It is not as structured as what we have for the criteria pollutants, which are ozone, particulate matter, and so forth. And I think one of the things that, because toxics are such a local issue in many cases, I mean, there are some national scale issues, but the majority of them are local and they're tied to individual sources. And so we have a program, an urban air toxics monitoring initiative, where we've been working with states and communities where they can get grant dollars from EPA to go in and do monitoring. And we've had several successes. I think one in Placerville, California was a rail yard. They went in, put monitoring in, found the problems, fixed the problems, and then they can take the equipment out. I mean, where with other pollutants where we're monitoring for like ozone and things where we're constantly looking at standards, you need to keep the monitors in place for a long time. Toxics is a little bit unique. If you can find the problem and you can fix it, you don't necessarily have to keep the monitoring there forever. You keep it there a little bit to verify that you fixed the problem, and then potentially you can move it to another place. So I think what we're trying to do, and I think the school study has been a good, it's going to provide new data for that, which will be great, is to get back to working with these communities again on a one-on-one basis. Where are these toxic problems? Where can we get the monitoring in place? And then work with, get back more to working with the local communities, because again, it's not necessarily a national scale problem on every pollutant. Some of them are very local, and we need that input from the local agencies to tell us, well, where do you think your problem is, and do that monitoring. And obviously, more money is always useful. I mean, the states I know are very limited right now with their resources and their ability to do monitoring. And so more resources is always helpful for states to get more monitoring equipment to be able to put in place to do this.
It's noon, actually, so we have to just a little one.
Yeah, just a tiny little thing.
Okay.
Laura, thank you again. I may have missed it. Will the screening analysis address chronic exposure effects? You talked some about short-term effects. Will it also get at potential chronic exposure effects?
What we're doing with the screening analysis is at the end of the analysis, when we have 10, 15 samples, whatever, we are going to do an extrapolation from that data to say, do we think there's potential for long-term exposure impacts here? And if so, what most likely will happen is we will continue to monitor, because to really do a full risk analysis, 10 samples is not enough to do a chronic. And so what we want to do is use the screening analysis to determine, do we need to do additional monitoring? And if so, at the end of that monitoring, you could actually do a much longer chronic assessment. But the screening will determine, do we do more monitoring to look at that chronic? We will compare it to some long-term numbers, but obviously we need to do more monitoring if we're going to do a full risk assessment.
I'd like to commend the EPA for posting this data as they're getting it, even though their own analysis right now is the kind of the short-term acute type analysis. I mean, you could go out and look at these numbers and find ways to get a snapshot over long-term as well if you wanted to. And it's also, it marks a change. A few years ago when we had an air monitoring study in Louisville, there was a little tussle between the EPA and the University of Louisville over how quickly air monitoring data would get posted and could it be posted kind of live on a website. And at that time, I mean, the University of Louisville started posting this stuff and the EPA wasn't really comfortable with that. But it's great to see information put out there for the public, and so I thank you very much for that. Okay, remember the tip sheets in the back, please. Please go upstairs to the ballroom and get seated for lunch right away for our Great Lakes session, and thank you very much for coming.